Eagles here?
Everybody, for the Hanukkah, I just want to continue. I think we're actually up to the history of Hanukkah. Basically, we start with the conquest of Alexander the Great, so to speak, of the Persian Empire. And this gave him control over Eretz Yisrael. As I indicated, Alexander the Great himself was not a... I call him great only because this is how he's known in history. We don't necessarily consider him to be spiritually great. But Alexander was a Hellenist. He was a devotee of Greek philosophy and literature and culture. And he had a huge, huge empire. And he wanted to spread all of his culture, not necessarily through coercion, but at least through assimilation, basically, by just building a lot of temples, building a lot of theaters, building amphitheaters, all of the different events that many, many Jews were unfortunately led astray. So one has to understand that the process that is called Hellenization did not begin with Antiochus, it began with Alexander's conquest and the like. Alexander died very young, 30-31, in Africa, probably of malaria. Legend has it that he cried out of heartbreak, he had no more worlds to conquer. The Gemara has a number of agadatas about Alexander. I think I had mentioned his encounter with Amazons in Africa. The Gemara in Maseches Tamid talks about and the like. But when Alexander died, his huge, huge empire was divided four ways. It was too big for a single person, and Alexander had many, had no children, but he had, some say he was homosexual, but he had no heir. And there were many, many power struggles who would take over. For our purposes, you need to know of two of the four branches, which are very, very critical. There is the branch that was taken over by Seleucus, and Seleucus took Turkey and Syria. And the second branch was Ptolemy. Ptolemy in English is spelled P-T-O-L-M-E-Y. In Hebrew it is called Ptolemy. The Ptolemaic dynasty ruled over Egypt. The Seleucid dynasty ruled over Syria. Now you understand, of course, if you can imagine the map, Eretz Yisrael is in between those two empires. And for the next 100, 150 years, Eretz Yisrael, this is called the Greek period, Eretz Yisrael is a football that is being kicked between the warring factions of the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucid Empire. Meaning, there are some years, truth is, it wasn't good for the Jews either way, but some years the Jews are under Ptolemy, and some years the Jews are under Seleucus. Now, you have to know that during this time, many, many Jewish people were assimilated. Some were intermarried, some were not keeping mitzvot. Even those who were religious were, like modern Jews today, like many of us today, were very, very involved in the secular and even pagan culture of Greece. Let me just remind you that Alexander established, this was not his capital, but he established a huge city in Egypt that he named after himself, Alexandria. And if you learned Maseches Sukkah, there is a description in the Gemara in Sukkah. The Jews in Alexandria were very assimilated, not that religious, but had a lot of money, were very wealthy. And the Gemara in Sukkah describes the huge, huge synagogue of Alexandria, which was called one of the wonders of the world, in which there were gold and silver thrones for different types of professions. And it was so large that you, without a microphone, you couldn't even hear the chazan. The chazan used to have a flag. You know, when the chazan ended a bracha, he would lift up a flag and people would say amen, etc. I don't know if you've studied the Gemara about Alexandria and the like. But keep in mind that the two major Jewish centers at this time is Eretz Yisrael, which is largely a religious center. The Tanoim were there. And then Alexandria, which was really very secular and decadent. At the same time of the Tanoim, the great Tanoim, you have a philosopher in Alexandria, Philo of Alexandria, and the like, who was observant but very, very assimilated at the same time. Now, if you remember the story, do you remember the story in Maseches Megillah of the Torah being translated into Greek? So it mentions Talmai HaMelech, King Ptolemy. But remember, they all had the name Ptolemy. The founder of that dynasty was Alexander's general, Ptolemy. But his successors were also Ptolemy. So there's Ptolemy the First and Ptolemy the Tenth, you know. So we don't know which Ptolemy exactly. But Ptolemy wanted to translate the Torah into Greek. And he took 70 elders and he put them in separate rooms to be sure that they would come up with the same translation, because that would prove to him that it was true. And it was a miracle. HaKadosh Baruch Hu caused everyone to have the exact translation into Greek. And even the changes that they made, which were changes, deviations, everybody came up with the same deviations. For example, the very first pasuk of the Chumash reads, Bereshit bara Elokim. In the beginning God created. Now if you read it absolutely literally, it would say, the beginning created God. Syntactically, right? You could, Bereshit bara Elokim. So, in order to avoid that potential heresy that God, God forbid, was created, they reversed the order. God created the beginning. That was a change they made. Now, you're not supposed to change the Torah. But if the Ovdei Avodah Zarah are going to misunderstand and distort, you need to clarify. Right? Another example, the Gemara says, that a rabbit, an arneves, which is a rabbit, is listed as a non-kosher animal because it doesn't have split hooves. But apparently, whatever the Greek name for rabbit is, Mrs. Ptolemy's name was that. So they didn't want to say the rabbit, let's say her name was Bonnie, or Bunny, right? Bunny. So they didn't want to say Bunny is impure. That would have been an insult to the king's wife. So they changed it to another word for rabbit and the like, and everyone came up with that other word. So this was the translation of the Torah into Greek. And this is known as the Septuagint, which is really Greek for the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70. Now you should know that the Jewish population of Alexandria was so non-knowledgeable that there's a lot of evidence that they actually read the Torah in Greek. That's why, if you remember, the Gemara in Megillah discusses the question, can you write a Sefer Torah in Greek? Can you write the Sefer Torah in other languages? And some opinions say no, but Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, well, maybe you can write it in Greek. And when you learn that Gemara, you really have a question. I mean, you know, I've never heard of anybody wanting to write the Torah in English. I mean, it's the Torah that you're going to read. Like, if the Mishnah discusses something, it must be it was some type of live issue. Why on earth would people be wanting to write the Torah in Greek? The answer is because the big, wealthy, assimilated community of Alexandria, they could not read Hebrew. Some say even Philo, who was religious and a very, very learned philosopher, only knew the Torah through the Greek translation of the 70 elders. And that is why the sages in Eretz Yisrael were willing to give a lenient ruling allowing the Torah to be written in Greek. Now, as far as I know, I don't think we have any evidence at all of a Torah scroll written in Greek, but the Talmud apparently says such things did exist. So it was a very, very assimilated, Hellenized, wealthy community. Sounds like America. A lot of money, but not too connected to Judaism in that way. So Eretz Yisrael itself, so there's a big population center in Alexandria and a big population center in Eretz Yisrael, but Seleucus is in charge of Syria and Turkey. Ptolemy and the dynasty is in charge of Mitzrayim, And Eretz Yisrael, through civil wars, is going back and forth between the Ptolemaic dynasty and the Seleucus dynasty. But the common denominator of both of these dynasties is they are adherents to the Hellenistic assimilationist philosophy of Alexander. Now, as I say, initially they were not coercive necessarily. They were not prohibiting Jews, but they were just creating a kind of, I'm not going to call it secularism because it really wasn't secular. I mean, Greek society had its own religion, which was paganism, but it was attraction to both the intellectual and the physical, and away from the spiritual focus on Hashem and morality. So, we now get to the Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story occurs in the 2nd century of the Common Era. Now remember, the Beis HaMikdash, I'm sorry, the 2nd century before the Common Era. The Romans aren't around yet. The temple is not going to be destroyed till the year 70. We are talking about 190 BCE. BCE means before the Common Era. BCE. So we're talking about more than 200 years before the destruction of the temple. Okay? And in a major, major military battle, one of the Seleucid kings conquered the land of Israel from the Ptolemaic kings. By the way, if any of you ever read the book of Daniel, now Daniel was written around the destruction of the first temple. The book of Daniel is a very mystical book. Just even if you took in English, it would be hard to make sense of things. But there's a long, long prophecy in chapter 11 of the book of Daniel, which talks about the wars between the king of the north and the king of the south, and how Eretz Yisrael will be sorely afflicted by those wars. Most Rishonim say this was a prophecy regarding the wars between Seleucus and Ptolemy, because Seleucus is the king of the north, Syria, and Ptolemy is the king of the south. So if you then look at the book of Daniel and then know the history that comes later, it is actually a prophecy of the Hanukkah story. Okay, so the king, the Seleucid king who conquered the land of Israel from the Ptolemaic dynasty, now we're going to get you a familiar name. His name was Antiochus. Antiochus conquered the land of Israel. Antiochus was actually, as military leaders go, quite a skilled military leader. It wasn't just Israel that he conquered. He conquered much of the Ptolemaic Empire. He brought it under his reign. He was a great military conqueror. But Antiochus had a different view of Hellenism that was a bit unique. Antiochus was the first king, who believed in promoting Hellenism through coercion. Alexander was doing it through persuasion and assimilation. Antiochus wanted to hurry up the process. And Antiochus began to promulgate, in fact, he's the first king in the ancient world who did this against Jews. He's the first king. It's very interesting. We're so used to these things happening. You know, Haman was earlier. But remember, Haman did not promulgate anti-religious, you could debate this, is Haman worse? Haman just wanted to kill everybody. But Haman did not make any rules about can't daven, can't learn, can't keep Shabbos. Haman was Hitler. Hitler didn't care. Were you religious, not religious? Antiochus only cared if you were religious. It was the other way around. You know, from a secular standpoint, you could actually say Antiochus was a great civil libertarian. Antiochus was not anti-Semitic. Antiochus said, hey, you Jews, just go along with the plan, be like everybody else, and you will have full political rights in this society. It's very much the opposite. It's very interesting. In other words, Antiochus was totally focused on the eradication of Judaism, not Jews. As opposed to Haman, who didn't care about Judaism, he just wanted to get rid of Jews. In fact, this is even reflected in Halacha. There's a famous passage of the Levush, one of the great poskim, who says, how come on Purim there is a mitzvah of having a physical meal, a physical party, and to drink and to eat? On Hanukkah, there is no chiyuv. You're not mechuyev to have a meal. You're not mechuyev to have... We have parties, but you're not mechuyev to have parties. The only mitzvah of Hanukkah is halal and lighting candles. On Purim, in addition to Megillah, you know, we have Sudas Purim, we have Shalach Manos. So the Levush says a very beautiful thought. The Levush says, because on Purim, the danger was to our physical survival. Since the danger was to our bodies, when God redeems us, we have to celebrate with our bodies. Eat, drink, give food. Hanukkah, the danger was not to our bodies. The danger was to our soul. So we celebrate with our soul, the candles, which is alluded to the soul. Now, of course, Hanukkah involved war. I mean, Hanukkah did involve danger to our bodies, but only because of the religious aspect, meaning we wound up fighting. But the fighting was only because of the desire to keep the Torah. If we were willing to assimilate, there wouldn't have been any violence at all. You have to understand that. In many, many ways, you could say, the Jews created the problem, properly so, because they were given the option. And Antiochus promulgated, so really, it's very interesting. This is the first anti-Torah law in history, explicitly anti-Torah law, right? And as we know, Chazal tell us that Antiochus promulgated a number of laws. He barred the practice of circumcision, Bris Milah, and Rosh Chodesh, the proclamation of Rosh Chodesh, because that gave the Jewish people control over time, etc. Sanctification of the holidays. He barred the public teaching of Torah. He barred really anything public. There were certain mitzvahs you could still do in private. And indeed, there were many other disgusting customs that were introduced at that time. For example, the Gemara tells us these are like almost side points, but they're awful things, that every virgin who got married, the first intercourse had to be with one of Antiochus's government officials, etc. That was, and then for, even for that, the Gemara indicates that's why the Jews changed the night of the week that people got married, so they shouldn't pick onto it. Just to give you another example, Haftorah, even a small custom like that. When did the Haftorah get introduced? The Haftorah got introduced during the persecutions of Antiochus, because what happened was Jews were allowed to have services. But Antiochus did not allow the public reading of the Torah. And he had guards in the synagogue to be sure that the Torah scroll would never be taken out and you'd be killed. So what the Chachamim enacted was, we would read something from the prophets that was connected to the Torah reading, so at least we would hear something from the Bible. So originally, the Haftorah was not something you did after the Torah reading. The Haftorah took the place of the Torah reading. That is why there's a halacha that the minimum number of verses of a Haftorah are 21, because that is the smallest possible Torah reading. Why is that so? Because every aliyah has to be at least 3 verses. And on Shabbos there have to be 7 aliyahs. So a minimum Torah read, now we read a whole parsha, but in terms of a minimum obligation, if you read 21 verses with 7 aliyos, you would have fulfilled. In other words, theoretically, you don't have to divide it according to the exact parsha. You know, you finish the Torah in a year, but if you only did half of the parsha this week, you could do a parsha and a half next week. But the minimum size of your kriya is 21 verses on Shabbos. So the Haftorah took the place of the Torah reading. It has to be 21 verses. Now later, when Antiochus was toppled, as we'll discuss, So theoretically, once we're able to read the Torah, you might give thought to not having a Haftorah, but the Chazal thought that Haftorah turned out to be a good thing, so we kept that as well. You know, in Judaism, we never take anything away. we just add. So once the Haftorah got in there, it stays in there. Right, so Antiochus, this was a very, very difficult time. A Jew could be killed for circumcision. A Jew could be killed for openly keeping Shabbos. A Jew could be killed for celebrating the holidays. A Jew could be killed for publicly reading the Torah. And once again, Antiochus had a certain measure of success. There were many, many Jews, if they weren't already assimilated, and many were, many Jews stopped keeping the Torah because of this coercion. We also have stories the other way. There were many martyrs who gave their lives. Now, you may ask the interesting question. You learn Sanhedrin, normally, if your life is in danger, the halacha is that you're supposed to violate the Torah to save your life, except in the case of the big three: idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder. But for kashrus, if your life is in danger, you eat treif. And yet, many Jews gave their life even to keep kashrus, but the answer is, they actually were chayav to give their lives, because if you remember, the Gemara tells us that the distinction that we make between the big three and all the other sins, that only applies when it is not a time of targeted religious persecution. But when the king is trying to destroy the Jewish religion, you must give your life even for a minor minhag that's not even a halacha. If Jews, for example, wore some distinct shoelaces to show that they were Jewish, and the government said, go back to the same shoelaces as the goyim, if they're doing it to take you away from Yiddishkeit, you must give your life. So we have Jews that responded in different ways. Many Jews gave their lives. They were killed as martyrs. Many Jews did not give their lives, and they actually violated the Torah. Yeah.
So what about nowadays when, like, Jews travel to hostile countries and they decide to tuck in their tzitzit or take off their kippah? Is that the same?
Well, it's an interesting, you know, it is an interesting question. I know that I had a shaila from a former student whose non-Jewish father works in Saudi Arabia, and he wants his son to visit him. And Saudi Arabia allows Jews, by the way. In other words, they make the point that, hey, you know, we certainly allow Jews. Jews have been in Saudi Arabia for 1,000 years, which is true. So they do allow Jews, although if you have an Israeli passport, you won't be able to get in. But, you know, they do not allow you to bring in tefillin. You cannot bring tefillin or sitter into the country. Talk about human rights. You know, Israel is the big violator of human rights. And I don't know what happened. So people were talking to me, you know, should I smuggle it in? Well, some people tell me, people who are more courageous than I, they tell me, well, you know, smuggle it in, you know, they're not going to find it. And the worst that'll happen if they find it is they will confiscate it and give it back to you when you leave the country. Well, okay, if I knew that would be the worst, you know, I would say, okay, risk it. But, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. They might behead you. I don't know, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. You know, I can't tell a person to smuggle in your tefillin into Saudi Arabia and let's see what happens. You know, we live in a world where, unfortunately, anything could happen. So it's a double pasha to me that you're not allowed to deliberately go to those countries. But you're 100% correct. It's not just those countries. We're talking about now France, Germany, England. You know, it's dangerous to walk around. Some parts of the United States, it's not smart to walk around with tzitzis out, or yarmulke, or whatever it is. But the question is, are you allowed to put yourself in? So I would say this. I would say, it's a subtle difference, but I would say that is not anti-religion. That is anti-Semitism, meaning there's a distinction. If I'm tucking in my tzitzis so they shouldn't know I'm Jewish, That's not the same thing as a law that says we don't allow you to wear tzitzis. Do you see the difference? Because one is targeted to the religion. The other is targeted to me as a Jew. And I know that's a subtle distinction. But Antiochus was saying, I know you're Jewish, and that's fine, but don't have those tzitzis on. Now, Saudi Arabia might be a different thing. Saudi Arabia is targeted directly against the religion. Okay. So this is the rekka. This is the background of the Hanukkah story. Again, we'll continue with this because we have Hanukkah. But the background is the anti-Jewish decrees of this king Antiochus and how the Jewish people would respond. This was a tremendous ace sarah. This in some ways was worse than the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Because the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we lost so much. But at least we had the Torah and we could keep the Torah. Babylonia didn't stop us from keeping the Torah. And Persia didn't stop us from keeping the Torah. But now we're in an exile where we can't keep the Torah. Or at least if we try to keep the Torah, our lives are going to be in danger for keeping the mitzvahs. So now, by the way, just a little and one more thought about Antiochus. Antiochus, even by his non-Jewish subjects, was regarded as a very, very cruel person. He persecuted other people as well. He gave himself the name Antiochus Epiphanes, which is Greek for Antiochus the Great. He called himself the Great. But behind his back, people changed it by one letter. Instead of being called Antiochus Epiphanes, he became known as Antiochus Epimanes. Epimanes means the insane one, the crazy one. So behind his back, they said he shouldn't be Epiphanes. He's not Antiochus the Great. He's Antiochus the Insane. And again, historians still discuss, was he a paranoid schizophrenic? Whatever it is, you can talk about evil, violent people. And he's had a very strong violence in his personality as well. Do we talk about them in terms of mental illness, or do we simply say they're evil? I'm sure there have been many psychiatric evaluations of Hitler and Stalin and the like as well, but still, free will is free will. And there are people who do go through difficult experiences in life but don't become mass murderers. So we don't exonerate. We don't let people off the hook because they had difficult experiences or the like. But this was Antiochus. Okay. So now we have to know about what some religious Jews did. What some religious Jews did was they simply ran to the mountains. They simply got out of the cities. Right? If you've ever gone in the direction of Hebron, right south of Jerusalem, towards the Dead Sea. So you see right away, as soon as you leave the city, you have the Judean desert. Right? It becomes desert right away. And all sorts of mountains, and in those mountains you'll see all sorts of little caves. Right? I'm sure you see it. Then you see some Arab grazing his goats and then having a tent with a big satellite dish. It's an amazing thing in the middle of it, getting 100 or 500 channels or whatever it is. So many people kept the Torah privately. They simply lived in caves. They just got away. After all, Antiochus didn't have enough soldiers to track everybody down. So people who were in isolated areas, they were able to keep. But there was one family of Kohanim who refused to leave Yerushalayim. Or they lived near Yerushalayim. They lived in Tekoa and Modi'in, near Yerushalayim. And this family is known as the Chashmonaim, the family of the Hasmoneans in English, but Chashmonaim. Now, why are they called Chashmonaim? It's not really clear. What is the origin of the term Chashmonaim? So some say, based on a verse in Tehillim, that Chashmonaim is a name that means nobility and aristocracy. And it refers to their spiritual nature. Because there is a similar word in Tehillim that is called Chashmanim. Now, Chashmanim, which does mean nobility, is not the same as Chashmonaim, but close enough. So some want to say it refers to nobility. Others say there's a city in the Bible that is called Chashmona. And that might have been the earliest known origin of the family. They came from Chashmona. But whatever the etymology is, they became known as the family of the Chashmonaim. And the patriarch of that family was a very old man towards the end of his life, whose name was Matisyahu. And he was too old to be involved in any type of battle, but he was the spiritual leader. Now, was Matisyahu the Kohen Gadol at this time? There's a certain ambiguity. In the prayer that we started saying last night, both in the Amida and in the Birkat HaMazon, if you're benching, we have the prayer Al Hanisim. So what does it say? Be May in the days of Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. That the whole story of Hanukkah started, didn't end, but it started in the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, the Kohen Gadol. So there is a machlokes. Which person is the word, is the phrase Kohen Gadol going on? Is it going on Yochanan? Or is it going on Matisyahu? Is it Matisyahu that was the Kohen Gadol? Or was Matisyahu just a private Kohen, but his father, Yochanan, who was not alive then, had been the Kohen Gadol, right? You see, syntactically, you can read it two ways. In the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, said Yochanan being the Kohen Gadol, or in the days of Matisyahu ben Yochanan, and Matisyahu was the Kohen Gadol. It's a machlokas. Some say Matisyahu was Kohen Gadol, some say Yochanan was Kohen Gadol. And there's a third view, that Kohen Gadol doesn't even mean high priest, it just means elevated and special, meaning a special Kohen, meaning it's not referring to the title Kohen Gadol. Now, what is very interesting is this, there's another question. The history here is very murky, but it's actually very significant when you connect it to other things in the Gemara. Let's assume for a moment that Matisyahu was not the high priest, but his father Yochanan was the high priest, who's not alive anymore. We do know in the Gemara of a Kohen Gadol whose name was Yochanan Kohen Gadol. And the Talmud tells us some funny things about this Yochanan Kohen Gadol. It mentions that he was Kohen Gadol for 80 years. And he was righteous for 80 years. But towards the end of his life, he became a Sadducee who denied the written, the oral Torah, and became a Hellenist. Now, if we are to assume that this Yochanan Kohen Gadol is in fact Matisyahu's father, which is another question, it might be a later one, then it's so fascinating that maybe part of why Matisyahu was so eager to revolt against the Tumah of Antiochus is he saw the destruction of what it created in his own father who had been a tzaddik. That would be, in other words, if you ask, like, what energized Matisyahu to take up this fight? It might be what happened to his father, if it was his father. But as I say, there's a lot of ambiguities because it could have been a later Yochanan, because names repeat themselves quite a lot here. There's another thing we know about Yochanan Kohen Gadol, but it may not be the same one, that's the problem, is that in his years of good leadership, he made a number of takanos, part of permanent rabbinic legislation. To give you one example, Demai. You know Demai? Demai is a law that the Mishnah talks about. In fact, there's a whole tractate, Maseches Demai, that when you buy grain from a person who is not learned in Israel, you are obligated to take off the tithes on the assumption that perhaps he didn't do it. That's called Demai. He is credited with that takana, right? So good things, bad things, very, very strange. Is it the same Yochanan? Is this Matisyahu's father, somebody else? Was Matisyahu a Kohen Gadol? A lot of questions. But Matisyahu began to encourage his sons to organize a revolution or a rebellion to overthrow Antiochus. Not for the purpose of political independence, but for the purpose of driving them out so that the Jewish people will be able. So it was a war of independence, but it was not a war of independence for political reasons. It was a war of independence in order to be able to reestablish the ability of the Jewish people to keep the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. Now remember, this whole time, there is a Beis HaMikdash. See, it's interesting. Antiochus is not against what you might call the rituals of Judaism. I mean, let them bring sacrifices, because that's similar. See, you have to understand, paganism is very tolerant of other gods. Meaning, you know, the Greeks have 100 gods, and the Jews have a god. So, have your temple to your god. But the Greeks didn't like religion intruding on private life. But once you finish with the temple service, become a regular citizen of the world. So the service in the Beis HaMikdash was going on even during Antiochus' time, until the war broke out. Then we'll see the war changed it. Until the war broke out, the one thing Antiochus didn't prohibit, he did not prohibit service in the temple. That went on. But he prohibited the observances outside of the Beis HaMikdash and life. But you understand the idea, because service in the temple superficially is very similar to the Greek worship. You know, you had temples to gods and you brought sacrifices. So that didn't bother Antiochus. You bring your sacrifices, we bring our sacrifices, that's perfectly fine. But don't be different than us. Once you want to be different, that's going to be a problem. Okay? So we'll continue with this. Next time we'll talk about the actual rebellion and how we get to the Hanukkah story. Okay?